Welcome to the RSP Cast. I'm Matt Waldman with the Rookie Scouting Portfolio. This is episode number 51. And today we're going to cover players whose games are beginning to grow on me as I evaluate them. Now, what does that mean? I think you have to get a little bit of a look into my process to understand really what that means, because it's not that I didn't like the player before and now I like him, I like him better. It's more about the fact that when I watch players, I tend to watch them in separate batches. I don't pick up the tape of a guy like Nick Chubb and watch, 15 games of him in a row. I don't think that's, for me, that's not the best way to do it, because I start to build up an expectation of what I'm going to see from him. Even though I have a defined process, even though I'm going through it on a checklist, I start to expect what I'm going to see from that player if I'm just watching 15 games over the course of 2 days or 3 days. So instead, what I like to do is to watch, maybe 3 games one day, maybe in 2 to 3 weeks, I'll watch another game. Maybe I'll go another month, month and a half, and I'll watch another 3 to 4 games. And then 3 months later, I'll watch another 3 to 4 games after that. So that when each time that I look at the player, I come to him with more of a fresh perspective, because I'm watching so many players that I tend to forget through that process what I saw before about them, what I liked about them, what I didn't like about them. I tend to forget that. And then at the end of my evaluation process, usually this month, I go back, look at all of my reports, and start to look at common things that I liked, common things that I didn't like, and also things that I need to see, so that I have a checklist of things that I'm looking for that haven't been answered based on the film that I've watched. Maybe if I were watching a guy like Nick Chubb and I still wasn't quite sure about his long speed based on the games that I watched, maybe he didn't have a lot of runs where he got into the open field based on how they were blocked, based on how the defense was playing him, based on injury, whatever it was, then I would, I'd have that checklist and I could go look and see, all right, I still need to see whether or not he has the type of long speed to beat cornerbacks who are on the same side of the field and have an angle on him. Or maybe I've only seen him beat cornerbacks who are coming from the opposite side of the field and their runs of no more than 30 yards. And I need to see him if he can outrun a cornerback who's coming from the opposite side of the field on a 60-yard run, or runs that are longer and take over half the field, things like that. And I look for those types of things as I go about it. And this helps reduce bias for me because, again, I'm looking at it fresh. Sometimes, quite by accident over the years that I've gone through this, is I'll watch a few games of a player, and even though I keep track of them, inadvertently, maybe I left one off of my tracking that I've watched, and I'll go, 3, 4, 5 months later, watch the same game by accident and notice in my database that I have another entry for it after I've already done the game. And it's an unintentional calibration in a sense, because it allows me to see whether I'm following the process, whether the process is clear enough. And if it is, then I'm usually seeing the same things, noting the same things about the player. If I'm not, it's either come down to I've learned something new, and I'm working towards defining that in a new way for upcoming rookie scouting portfolio evaluations, or maybe it was an area that was kind of a gray area where the situation that I was observing could be defined in one way or another, and I chose for specific reasons option A, and then the second time it was a tough call and I chose option B. And what I found is that I oftentimes, if I've done that, I've often noted that I could see how it could fall into option A even though I took option B. And in that case, I feel pretty good about the fact that I'm also still seeing the gray areas in my criteria and where I'm trying to address that over the course of the, you know, the business and the evaluation process that I have. But what happens oftentimes is that as you're watching tape, you don't see everything in one game from a player. You're not going to see them in situations where they can show everything that they can or can't do. So sometimes I'll look through, you know, 8 to 9 games of a player in the first few months of my evaluation process and have some lingering questions. And then the reason the player's grown on me is that those were answered either yes or, you know, whether I thought they could, but I haven't seen it yet, or whether I didn't think they were a certain style of player or were capable of certain feats and then was able to see otherwise. And there are a few players who match both, you know, today that we're going to talk about. There's a couple here who I thought looked good, but wasn't positive that they were able to reveal certain things in their game that they actually did. And then there were other players who I expected them to do well and to play well, but I hadn't seen enough yet. And then when I watched later, I observed the things that I expected that he probably could do, but didn't have proof of. And I wasn't grading him in, you know, favorably for that. So his score may have been lower because I needed proof. And then I ended up seeing that proof. So hopefully that gives you an idea, a little bit about my evaluation process, what that means about why players grow on me, why I think it's important to break up the evaluation of players so you're not watching them all in a row. I tend to do that at the end when I start to have maybe a punch list of 2 to 3 things I'm looking for. And I end up going back and rewatching games that I've already seen in addition to games that I haven't to just look for 1 or 2 things to see if they're there. I did that a lot with Nick Chubb as an example last year. So that kind of gives you an idea. And that's why also I don't keep up with the narrative. So like who won the Heisman, who's contending for the national championship, who, you know, those types of things. I don't really know that stuff anymore. To me, this is a job of watching players in college is a job for me. I enjoy watching football. Obviously, I love it. But the game that I love keeping up with in terms of its narrative and the storylines as it grows is the pro game. And I study the pro game the same way I study the college game, but I also keep up with the narratives. Whereas the college game, I try to avoid the narratives because it allows me to see these players without a level of, you know, presumption or bias about who they purportedly are and how good they purportedly are. So who are some players that are growing on me? The first one off the bat, probably not going to be a high-end pick, but he's someone that I liked from the get-go, and he's shown a little bit more than, you know, than what I did. And the first time I saw him, let's just put it this way, his name's Olamide Zaccheaus. He's a wide receiver out of Virginia, 5'8", 190 pounds, former running back, plays in the slot and a little bit on the outside. And he's a total yardage, you know, phenom for UVA. And when I saw him, I could definitely tell that he had the capacity to be a physical player. He had the capacity to be a decent route runner, but I didn't get a chance to see that in its fullest expression. And while I still would like to see more, and I still need a little bit more confirmation that he can consistently get off the line of scrimmage and run sharp routes, I'm beginning to see that more and more as I watch his tape, evidence of that. So I'm pretty optimistic that Zaccheaus can become a decent wide receiver in the slot who can also be used outside to win on occasion and give you a little bit more than just a short and intermediate threat, or more than just a, you know, a jet sweep guy like Tavon Austin. I think he can give you maybe not John Brown when John Brown's healthy, but maybe a Taylor Gabriel type of player, a guy who in Chicago or Atlanta can be used on dig routes from the outside or run the post route or used on screens and give you big plays. But then you can also move him inside and have him do some work for you there. And be you know, a competent, versatile option who also delivers in the return game. So Olamide Zaccheaus, right off the bat, a guy who's starting to grow on me as I watch him. Another wide receiver who's starting to grow on me is J.J. Arcega-Whiteside. Not that I didn't like his game, but I wanted to see a little bit more with his route running because it was very clear from the beginning the way that Stanford liked to use him. And you could see that he can post people up. He can win the ball in the air. He's a big dude at, what, 6'3", 225. Not very sudden. That was the thing that kind of concerned me is he's not extremely sudden. He's a jump ball type of guy. Stanford oftentimes recruits a lot of guys like that who are kind of in the middle of being not, they're not quite a tight end who can block, but they're not a downfield receiver in the pro game when you project them because they're kind of on the slow or less sudden side. But watching Arcega-Whiteside and getting to see more of his film, I like his route running. And I think that he's a good enough technician that he's going to be able to build on that skill and become a complete receiver. He may never be a sudden player, a really sudden guy who's going to win against top corners one-on-one just on the merit of his routes alone. But I think the combination of his physicality and his ability to decelerate, and what I mean by is that to be able to slow down quickly and drop the weight in his hips so he could come to a quick stop, means that he's going to be able to develop into a complete route runner who can run the dig routes and the curl route and the comeback and the out and do it in a manner where he can really sell that. And it can also set up some of his deeper routes because of the fact that he can get a defender to take false steps and then use his frame and his arms and legs to be able to work free against physical coverage, use that arm over or chop or a rip move. He can use 3- and 4-step releases. And I'm noticing a little bit of skill in terms of pacing so that he can create not just being as predictable with one or two different types of releases, because certain types of routes or certain types of coverages will call for certain types of release patterns, 3-step or 4-step, and a certain type of that. But it doesn't mean that you want to just run it the same rhythm and stride length every time. You want to vary it up so that you can get the defender to bite in a way. So you have to be a little bit more creative about it. And I think Arcega-Whiteside is starting to show that in addition to his weight drop with that ability to come to a stop. I like what I'm seeing from him. So I see him as a little more multidimensional, and that gives me hope and makes me feel like he's a player who's growing on me and looking more and more like the type of prospect who belongs in that top range of receivers based on what it is a team's looking for. Because remember, my list of 80-something receivers I'm looking at is vastly different than an NFL team that's decided for their scheme, for the player types that they covet, they may only have 5 guys on their board. And Arcega-Whiteside, as good as he might be for a certain team, might not even be on another's list. So it's something worthwhile to keep in mind when we're looking at players from that regard. So let's move on and take a look at some running backs, because those are the other 3 players that are rounding out my board as far as players who are growing on me. And the first one that comes to mind that's growing on me is Justice Hill, Oklahoma State. You know, when I first saw him, definitely loved the speed and quickness. You could see that he's a guy that has moves on top of moves, and he can catch the ball reasonably well. He can get outside on a defense, and he showed some skill in terms of cutback ability. But I was wondering about his balance, his, you know, how creative he really was in terms of movement. Could he create solutions that were efficient in addition to being, you know, dynamic? Because it's one thing to be able to dance around and make 3 people miss, but if you're losing 3 yards in the process and now you're hemmed in by 5 unblocked players, doesn't really matter how agile you are. So when I watch Hill, the more I've seen, I like his contact balance. I think he has good contact balance for his size, which means that he may not be the quintessential every down thumper in a, you know, that you see from 215, 220, 230 pound backs who are going to get the ball 18 to 20 times a week if they're the studs. You know, they're not going to be the Ezekiel Elliott or the healthy Todd Gurley. And by the way, I don't believe for a second that Todd Gurley's been healthy since the Kansas City game in the first quarter when he got hit out of bounds at the right sideline and he got up in a very weird ginger way with his right knee. I think they've been hiding that, and they know that if they admit to him being hurt, there's probably going to be some issues with the league office. So anyway, tangent over with that. Justice Hill, I think he's a guy that kind of spans that range of, if all things come together, maybe he can give you what a Chris Johnson did at his height of his career. But he's more maybe in that range of guys like Theo Riddick to Reggie Bush, players who can be helpful in the receiving game as third down players, who can go out and make plays in the flats and over the middle, but also give you enough as a runner in a spread look or with teams that employ a lot of misdirection and motion, that Hill can give you those 12 to 18 touches per game and deliver some big plays. And what you're leaning on for him is that you may have some plays that don't work out very well. You may even have a slew where he's limited to small gains of, you know, 1 to 3 yards, but he can bust out a run that's a big play run, maybe 3 or 4 of those in a game, and give you strong production and put defenses on notice. His junior tape really caught my eye more than his senior tape. Sophomore tape over his junior tape. Watching the Oklahoma game in particular, some of the skill that he's shown being able to work the perimeter and then cut downhill was really impressive, because one of the hardest things to do from a footwork and balance standpoint is to show that hip and ankle flexion on a run where you're working at a good clip of speed east-west, and then you have to get north-south and transition fast. Can you bend that run well, where you're kind of bending it like a motorcycle and kind of, I don't remember the exact term for that word, but it's kind of a curve that you run at. And if you can do that quickly without losing balance, that's a really nice skill. But also, you often see guys, what they do is, as they're working east-west, they can, within 1 to 2 steps, they can drop their weight, bend their knees, ankles, and hips, and make that cut downhill with just 1 or 2 steps of transition. And some guys can do it almost without even an extra step. They can just hop into that downhill position, flip their hips, and go with that little loss of speed. Justice Hill needs about 1 step, maybe 2, which to me is starter level when it comes to that ability to transition from east-west to north-south. So I was impressed with that. But also I was further impressed by the layers of moves that he had to avoid contact and still get downhill. He comes to stop really well, but he can also cut on the move well enough that he doesn't have to stop his momentum. And I saw a lot of layers of creativity to his game as a cutback runner and as a guy who creates his own space. So really liked that, in addition to his ability to at least get a push on linebackers, sometimes beat linebackers in direct collisions where they're, you know, head on head. It doesn't mean that he's running over the guy, but it means maybe that he establishes contact at a head on angle, close to a 90 degree angle, if not a total 90 degree angle, and then be able to spin off or get under the contact and drive forward and at least gain 1 to 2 yards through that contact with a lean, or keeping his feet moving as he's pushing that defender and moving that man backwards. And I think that that's a very important skill for running backs to have when they're playing in the NFL, is that ability to at least win against linebackers. If they can do that, and that win can be a small win, they have enough balance and power to ride the ride. And I think Justice Hill has that. So I'm becoming more excited about what I see there, because he's a big play artist who has a little bit more consistency potential play to play. Another guy if he could just hold on to the football, this next guy, he could be a really strong prospect in this draft class. And that's Michigan State's LJ Scott. You know, I think I saw something last night after watching another batch of his tape. I just went to look up bio work, but I saw something in my search about something about how he hasn't given enough this year for people to see how good he really is or to be able to evaluate him. And again, my belief is it's quality, not quantity. If you're getting enough tape that answers the right questions and you're asking the right questions, you're going to see what you need to see. And with LJ Scott, let me tell you something. Nice size player, 220, 225, 6'1". And I can see how maybe some people might look at him and say, he's a Michigan State back. He's kind of big. He's a really fluid mover. I mean, jump cuts, stop cuts, parallel cuts, spin moves. He can layer his moves in different combinations to really create space for himself. And then he also has the power to push people backwards or to run through reaches, wraps, or hits. And that balance and power, along with that footwork and the ability to process it all and do it with quickness. There's some suddenness to his game. I can see how people might want to compare him stylistically to Le'Veon Bell. Now, I'm not there yet in terms of when I look at LJ Scott. I don't really see him as, you know, Le'Veon Bell in that way. But another player who I really liked coming out of school was Matt Forte. And I can kind of see a little bit of that Matt Forte in LJ Scott's game, even though Scott can show a little bit of that patience to wait to the last minute and then speed up in the way that Bell does in a crease. But Scott, whether it's Forte, whether it's Bell in style, he's a guy who really can create with his footwork and quickness. And then you have the power element to his game as well. He can catch the ball. Someone that I think that gives you that every down presence in his game. The only issue is, again, ball security. It doesn't look too bad technically, but he's fumbled the ball enough that it's a concern. And while my buddy Adam Harstad, who works at footballguys.com, talks about how fumbles don't tend to be a very predictive stat, and that looking at ball security rates don't provide that predictability that that people are seeking. And sometimes it also, I think he theorized, and I may be saying this incorrectly or assessing something wrong about his conclusion, but I believe he said that that it may not be predictive, because sometimes a player can have a confidence problem that can get worse. You know, or they overthink about it, and it wasn't a problem before, and now it's become a problem. And we've certainly seen that with some players. But at the same time, I've seen guys, and this is more anecdotal, but guys like Amir Abdullah and David Wilson who had fumbling problems, and they continue to have them. But then, you know, there are guys who were able to stop some of their fumbling problems over the course of their career with just being technically sound, like Tiki Barber being that prime example. So LJ Scott, he's going to have to get a little bit better in terms of hanging on to the ball. I think, you know, the elbow can be a little bit tighter, but you often see the ball high to his chest and reasonably tight in terms of his forearm and being tight towards his upper torso. It just needs to be the elbow needs to be a little bit tighter there. But this is a guy who, when I look at him, he could very well, I mean, depending on how he performs at the combine, and if he's completely healthy enough to go, I could see him being one of the best prospects in this class at the position. And while this position doesn't have the overall talent of last year or the year before, maybe not the year before, might be on par with the year before. There's some good talents here. It's a quality class. It's just not the superstar class of what I thought last year was, even though for fantasy players, they'll often say, oh, it wasn't that great because they didn't have the production. But I'm talking about talent. I'm not talking about production. And there's some difference there. Moving on from LJ Scott, another back who, and I will say this is the final back on this list, and we'll end this podcast on this note, is a guy who, when I first watched him, he kind of reminded me of Leonard Fournette in style, maybe Carlos Williams, big guy, speed, you know, good quickness, some speed, ability to maybe make the first man miss or create within a gap or two of his, really within a gap of where he's heading downhill and being more of a downhill thumper type at 6'3", 234. And that's FSU running back Jacques Patrick. So I thought he was kind of those guys. So then I'm, you know, I've watched a few of those games. I've watched a few games, you know, back in August. I was watching more games yesterday. And he's more than just a gap runner. He can run zone. He's a fine receiver, catches the ball extremely well, pretty darn good pass protector too. But I was just really impressed with how he could keep his knees up, get his feet high, and avoid reaches and wraps. He could come to quick stops and layer moves together in sequences that allowed him to avoid penetration into the backfield repeatedly against different teams, and doing it in a manner that was really with good short area quickness. I mean, impressive short area quickness. And then when he got downhill, he could finish strong and break reaches and wraps, bounce off of hits. He had a nice spin. He had some jump stops, jump cuts. He had the ability to really just alter his stride length and avoid penetration in a way that you would assume he was a scat back. But at 6'3", 234, somewhat unusual. And that's not the type of thing you normally saw with Carlos Williams or Leonard Fournette. The guy that I remember seeing that with, who was roughly his size, but a little bit, but actually about 16 pounds heavier, was LeGarrette Blount. Also, Anthony Dixon was pretty darn good at that. But I think Jacques Patrick is a better athlete than maybe those two guys might. And that's what I'm looking forward to see at the combine. Jacques Patrick plays with Cam Akers, who is a wonderful back, wonderful young back, who, you know, it's kind of like putting Nick Chubb with Sony Michel or having Todd Gurley in front of both of them. There's going to be, you're not going to be the every down guy at the level that your talent may be deserving of. And so when watching Jacques Patrick in recent games, I realized how impressive he really was to me. And when I say that, I'm not talking that he's, you know, that he's a, you know, future all pro, though, you know, he's not far enough. He's far enough away. I mean, excuse me. He's close enough that of a talent that he might have a shot to become a starter in the NFL at some point. I think he has that kind of skill. Really impressed with Jacques Patrick's ability in short yardage, his ability to break multiple tackles, generate a push, but he wasn't just physical like LeGarrette Blount. He could make people miss. And what was most impressive is that ability to read what the line happening at the line, see the penetration. Instead of making a more dynamic cut, he could open his hips and just point the toe and efficiently bounce a play outside as he's taking the exchange without a crazy move or a move with a high degree of physical difficulty. He was just so efficient with it. Something that you'd see with veteran backs. This is a really good running back who might be overshadowed a little bit by the talent that's also on the squad with him, considering that he played with Dalvin Cook and also with Cam Akers. So he's kind of one of those guys that kind of fell in between. And if you're an older fan of the game, you may remember guys like William Andrews, who played blocked for Joe Cribbs. You may remember guys like Marcus Allen when he blocked for Charles White. You may remember you know, players who CJ Anderson, who, you know, I believe may have blocked for Javid Best at one time, or whoever Cal had at that time. Terrell Davis, who was considered maybe being made a fullback because of Garrison Hurst. You know, there's lots of instances of players who turn out to have better pro careers than they did college. And it was just because they were overshadowed by a player who was a strong talent in his own right, and the team wanted to get on the field equally or greater in frequency in terms of usage. So Jacques Patrick, 6'3", 234, I think he can run both types of schemes that you normally see in the NFL. LJ Scott, he can cure some of the ball security woes, could easily be a top three back in this class and someone who could deliver that starter production as a every down guy, can give you maybe that Matt Forte-like, Le'Veon Bell-like all-around skill. Excellent receiver. And then Justice Hill, someone who might give you that, you know, Philip Lindsay-like element, Reggie Bush-like element, Chris Johnson-like element, depending on who, what team he lands on and what he can show with his balance. At worst, I think he's like a Joe McKnight, may he rest in peace, you know, kind of a player who can deliver that utility role in 2-minute drills, 5-minute drills, when a team's behind situationally, he could be a big play guy, Theo Riddick-like in that respect. And then we have J.J. Arcega-Whiteside, more than just a big play perimeter jump ball threat, and Olamide Zaccheaus, more than just a slot receiver, possibly more than just a slot receiver and return specialist, could be a more versatile option who might be able to do work for you on the outside if he can translate some of that physical play off the line of scrimmage. And I'm seeing some signs of that. So those are five players who are beginning to grow on me this year. Now, again, I'd like to thank you for listening to this RSP cast. If you've enjoyed the RSP cast, please subscribe on Twitter. Excuse me, on iTunes. You can subscribe on iTunes at Matt Waldman's RSP cast. Rate and review for me. If you want to give me more feedback and you prefer to do it by email, you can contact me at mattwaldmanrsp@gmail.com. The RSP is getting ready to be written. This month I'm running out film study, and then I'll be writing the chapters and getting the book and the reports put together in March for its April 1 publication date, which has been the date I've been doing every year since 2006. You can get the RSP at mattwaldman.com. Remember, 10% of every sale goes to Darkness to Light, which is an organization that is designed to train communities, whether it's teachers, firefighters, Boy Scout troop heads, churches, elementary schools, businesses, individuals, trains them on how to prevent sexual abuse of children, what the dynamics are, how to spot potential predators, how to keep kids in a safe environment, how to understand also how to address sexual abuse when it does happen. Because when sexual abuse happens, oftentimes, you know, the statistics show that when a kid says that something inappropriate has happened to them, 99% of the time, that's been the case. You need to believe it. And when you don't believe it, it compounds the issue. The kid doesn't learn to trust themselves. They tend to think that they're not worthwhile. They tend to think that that ruins their self-esteem. It can create some major problems in lives. And if when you want to think about, and this is pretty heavy, but when you want to think about, you know, some of these shows that are popular on Netflix that I see about serial killers, you know, and one of the big markers of serial killers is cruelty to animals. And they say that's a predictive marker. But a lot of these people who have dealt, who have behaved in these ways as serial killers were sexually abused as children. And oftentimes, you know, it's an uncomfortable subject, but oftentimes that's been also an indicator, and with a cocktail of other very difficult situations. But part of that too is that when children at a young age, if they've been abused, and they have an outlet to be able to talk to someone, and people are going to be able to handle that and not push it under the rug or not believe them or deny it, that person has a fighting chance to really thrive in their lives without having to untie an even greater number of knots. On top of the fact that you see what happens to institutions when they cover it up or try to deny it. We've seen that in the football world and the athletic world in recent years, and the kind of mess and torment it creates in communities with families and the individuals involved. So this organization is great in being able to create training to help people address it better, understand it better, as well as prevent it, which is obviously the most important thing. So Darkness to Light, proud to be able to represent you guys in giving to them, you know, on a percentage of each sale. And of course, you get a great product pre-draft, post-draft that comes out week after the NFL draft. You can take the tour on my YouTube channel, Matt Waldman RSP Film Room. You can take the tour of both the pre-draft and post-draft publications there and see all that you get. I know that you will be pleasantly shocked if you haven't gotten it before. Just ask around on Twitter or Reddit or any football message board what you think of, you know, what they think of the RSP. And I believe that probably at least 9 times out of 10, you're going to get some people who are raving fans of what's there. So thanks again for listening. Hope you guys have a wonderful week. And the next time I'm on, might be even a little sooner than a week, I have somebody scheduled that I think you'll enjoy, who's owns a couch that I tend to frequent. Thanks again.